Thank you very much, Stephen. Well, each year in August, because people are away on different Sundays, instead of doing a series as we normally do, we do a kind of different self-contained topics. And this year we're looking at some of the short, smaller books of the New Testament. And today is the shortest of all. 2 and 3 John are the shortest books in the whole Bible, in fact. And I'd be quite surprised if anyone here has ever heard a sermon on them. I've certainly never preached one. But today we're going to look at this letter that Stephen just read the whole of, which is called 2 John. It's a letter from Jesus' disciple John, who was probably the closest person to Jesus during his time on earth. We know John was the younger brother of James. They were both two of the 12 disciples, and there's some evidence that he may have been younger than the other disciples, which may be why Jesus seems to have been particularly protective of him and particularly close to him. And he wrote what might be the most influential bit of writing ever written in the whole of human history, John's Gospel. And he also wrote 3 letters that are in the New Testament. 1 John is 5 chapters long, and then we got these 2 John and 3 John, which are both only about 300 words of Greek, only one sheet of papyrus, just like a very ordinary letter. 3 John was written to an individual, a friend called Gaius, but 2 John seems to have been written to a church. And if you want to have it in front of you, it's on page 1229. And you'll see there that John starts by just calling himself the elder, which may just mean an old man. He doesn't give himself any airs or graces or fancy titles. He just calls himself the elder. How different from the pomposity and self-importance of many parts of the church down the centuries. The person who is closest of all to Jesus just calls himself the elder. Doesn't set himself above or apart from anyone else. And it's the elder to the chosen lady and her children whom I love in the truth. And that is almost certainly referring not to a person, but to a church. If you look to the end of the letter, it says, the children of your chosen sister send their greetings. So that's the church probably that John was writing from. Chosen lady, chosen sister, her children are a way of referring to these groups of Christians who have come together in new families, i.e. the churches. And the key theme of the letter seems to me to be evident really from the first section, the first sentence. The chosen lady and her sister whom I love in the truth. Love and truth going together. And if you look onto verse 3, you'll see that combination again. Verse 3 is really just a conventional greeting. Grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son will be with us in truth and love. Truth and love, the two inextricably combined together, like interwoven, like the double helix of DNA, for instance. And that combination of love and truth is really the theme of the first paragraph from verse 4. Let me read you verses 4 and 5. Verse 4 is about truth. Verse 5 is about love. It has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us. And now, dear lady, I'm not writing you a new command, but one which we've had from the beginning. I ask that you love one another. Truth and love. And then we see them coming together in verse 6. This is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you've heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. Obedience to the truth, to his commands, leads to loving one another. And he talks about walking in love, verse 4, walking in the truth, verse 6. Now, maybe that's a bit of a surprise to us, because we tend to think of love and truth as kind of opposites in tension with each other. Love is in the heart, truth is in the head. Love is emotional, truth is intellectual. Love is something that just happens to you, you don't control it. Truth is something you work at, you learn. Love is open, truth is closed. Truth brings disagreement, but love unites us and heals. We sense somehow that they're kind of in conflict with one another. And we know at the same time that love is in the end what matters. If we could just love one another, then our problems would be over. We know that every human being's greatest need is to love and be loved. The one thing every little child needs, that grace needs and every little child needs, is to be securely loved. If you're not loved in the first few years of your life, all the evidence suggests you never really get over that. Love is essential to being human. It is the answer. But the surprise of this letter is that John says, "I love you in the truth." It's the truth that produces the love. Verse 6 again, his command is that you walk in love. In other words, love is not just a feeling, not just something that happens to us, but something we're commanded to do, something we choose to do. Not just an involuntary passion, but a deliberate choice. John is generally believed to be the only one of the 12 disciples who died a natural death. All the others were martyred for their faith. But John seems to have somehow managed to live on into old age. And there's a story from Jerome, one of the early church historians, that when John was very old, he used to be carried in to the church in Ephesus. And he was so weak he could no longer preach, but he would always say the same phrase to that church. And it echoes what he says in this letter. He would say, "Little children, love one another." When people grew a bit tired of always hearing him say the same thing and asked him why he repeated it so often, he said, "Because it is the Lord's command and because it is enough." It's the Lord's command to love one another, and it is enough. So I guess we need to try and engage our brains this morning and think, how can you command love? How can love be something that Jesus commands us to do? We tend to think of the commandments, they're on the wall behind me, as a series of rather negative things, a series of thou shalt nots that restrict us and stop us doing things. But when Jesus was asked about them in that first reading in Matthew's Gospel, he said you can summarize them as just two things: love God and love your neighbor. That's what the commandments are teaching us, to love God that way and to love our neighbor that way. And when we think about it, we begin to realize that that's true. If you love people, you don't lie to them. You don't bear false witness about them. That's the ninth commandment. You don't take things away from them that are their possessions. That's the eighth commandment. Don't steal. You don't envy them. You don't covet what they have for yourself. That's the tenth commandment. You're faithful and trustworthy. That's the seventh commandment. Don't commit adultery. You don't use force to coerce them or control them. That's the sixth commandment. So if you want to know how to love someone, then obey the commandments. And it's the same with the first four, which are about loving God. Put him first in your life. Give him all of your heart. Don't allow the pressures of your life to squeeze him to the margins. Make time for him. Don't distort him and create a false, easy, comfortable God. Those are the first commandments. That's what it means to love God and to love our neighbor. Verse 6 again, this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. Love is much more than an involuntary passion or a vague intention. It's a deliberate, step-by-step choice to do what is right, this way and that way. And I suggest to you that grasping that is one of the most important bits of wisdom that you need to live your life well. It's what it means to love in the truth. Let me ask you a different question, which is, what is the unique selling point of the church? What can the church offer that no one else can? To many people we know, church feels irrelevant and pointless. Why on earth would I go to a place where odd people are doing odd things? Well, I want to say to you, whether you're a regular or a visitor this morning, that there is something which everyone needs, which I think pretty much the church only is in a position to offer. We all have an image, don't we, of a perfect body, male or female, and we know how to get one. You go to the gym or the fitness center, you pay your money, you talk to the instructor, and they tell you what to do. And if you work at it and you put in enough energy and effort with your program of exercises, eventually you will see results. But where do you go if you want to improve your character? If you want to learn to love people better? If you want to be a better person? If you want to learn to be kinder, more forgiving, more honest, more generous? Where do you go to learn that? Because your character is what really matters, isn't it? Much more important than your abs or glutes or pecs. A female doctor in Nick Hornby's book, How to Be Good, says, "I want someone wise to teach me the things I need to know in order to live the rest of my life. I want someone to teach me those things I need to know to live my life wisely." But where do we go to get that? We know, don't we, that we're suffering in our culture from a crisis of character. Endless stories of bad behavior by greedy bankers, debauched celebrities, phone-hacking journalists, dishonest politicians. And our only answer to those things seems to be to set up a new set of rules, new procedures, a public inquiry. But we know that that won't really change anything, will it? How do we get people to change on the inside? Well, that, I suggest to you, is what the church does. Little children, says John, love one another. In community, as we come together, we can help to learn to love each other, that most challenging and yet most important of tasks. And the church has been doing that for a very, very long time, right back from when John wrote this letter. Verse 5 again, "I'm not writing you a new command, but one which we've had from the beginning. I ask that you love one another." John was one of the closest people to Jesus, and therefore he knew that love in the truth, love in obedience to the commands, is what matters. I think it's very interesting that other religions don't talk about loving their leaders. They don't talk about loving Muhammad or Buddha or Confucius, admiring them, respecting them, following them, yes, but not loving them. That would seem somehow inappropriate to talk about loving those great leaders. But Christians, by contrast, talk about loving Jesus all the time. It's absolutely central to our faith. Almost all of our songs sing about it. And in fact, if you only talk about admiring Jesus or respecting him, then probably you haven't really got it. You haven't understood who he is. To know him is to love him. And the community that grows up around Jesus exists to put love into practice, to love one another. From the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. Let me just be clear about one thing. If you're visiting, you won't be under any illusions about this if you're a regular member. But you might be if you're visiting. And that is that Christians don't claim to be better people than anyone else. We are just as flawed and weak and fallible as everyone else. Indeed, often more so. Becoming a Christian involves admitting and facing your own weakness and failings. That's why we have a confession in every service, when we admit to God and to one another that we failed. So we know that we're flawed and imperfect, but we are on a journey of change. We're learning together to walk in love, to walk in obedience to the truth. It's very hard to do that on your own, but in community, you have a chance. And the truth that we're trying to learn to walk in is the Creator's pattern for human flourishing, the love he commands us to show that way and that way. Churches are designed to be character-forming communities, to help us grow in inner health and fitness. Don't you want to do that? I don't know where else you go. You're not going to learn it from the self-help books. You have to be in community and putting it into practice and learning to walk in love together. And that is right at the center of what the church has been doing for 2,000 years. My son is now 12, and over the last decade, he has been given by lots of kind people quite a large number of Lego models, most of which I have ended up helping to make. And as anyone who's made one can tell you, they are not as easy as they look. Even the simplest ones, if you don't meticulously follow the instructions, you'll end up with something that looks nothing like the picture on the box and with half the pieces still on the carpet. Well, think about the complexity of our world, the different choices we have to make every day, our different competing desires for money, sex, power, status, security, significance. Think about the choices we have to make every day in our lives. That's a lot more complex, I can tell you, than a simple Lego model. Do we really think we're going to be okay if we don't bother to follow the maker's instructions? If we just go with the flow, if we just make it up as we go along? We need to follow his commands. We need community and we need one another. To the chosen lady and her children whom I love in the truth, says John, and not I only, but all who know the truth, because of the truth which is in us and will be with us forever. God's truth is at work in us and through us, enabling us to love one another. Now that, of course, means that truth matters. And that's really what the second half of the letter is about. We're not going to have time to look at that this morning, though we will look at it more this evening. But I just want to read you quickly the paragraph from verse 7, which is about the importance of protecting and preserving the truth. Many deceivers who don't acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. Watch out that you don't lose what you've worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully. Anyone who runs ahead and does not continue in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever continues in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take him into your house or welcome him. Anyone who welcomes him shares in his wicked work. That's tough stuff, isn't it? John is determined to defend the truth because he knows that the truth is what creates this community of love. He talks there about people running ahead and not continuing in the teaching. And maybe that's what these false teachers are saying. We've got something new, something more exciting. But John is saying if it takes you away from the original teaching about Jesus, then don't let them in. Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, then you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. That truth about Jesus is what enables us to love one another. So truth has to be defended. We don't just accept any teaching. We test it, examine it, see if it is in accord with what Jesus taught, with orthodox Christian teaching. We know that there are deceivers, there are the forces of evil, the Antichrist, John describes it as. And so we need to beware of allowing false teaching in to damage the church. So this is the shortest letter in the Bible, and it's showing us that love and truth go together. Truth, obedience to the commands, is what enables us to love one another. From September, we're going to be doing a series on the Ten Commandments and how do we learn to love each other and to love God in the 2016. It's the authentic Jesus and the truth about him that enables us to love each other. Little children, said the aging John as he was carried into the church, love one another. It's the Lord's command and it is enough. And the church community is the place, I believe, which will enable us and empower us to develop our characters for good and to learn to love one another and be the people that we were created to be. So we're going to sing a hymn about love.